flickering rapidly on and off. The stage lights did the same, the colors appearing and disappearing so that the whole space was washed first in bright gold, then a sickly green, then a bruised and vicious purple. They blinked like strobes, and the effect was nauseating. The speakers blared brief bursts of static, cutting in and out like the lights, and beneath the static was the same sound they had heard the night before, the growling of a voice too low to be human, too indistinct to be speaking words. The group came together cautiously, not quite trusting their own senses. The lights throbbed savagely, and as Charlie walked toward her friends, she could not be sure how far away they were or what was right in front of her. They huddled in the middle of the floor, staring at the animals as they rattled and rocked as if with their own agenda. Carlton got to his feet. Jessica watched him with concern, but he waved her off.
"I told you, I'm fine," he said, shouting to be heard over the intermittent noise.
Charlie stood fixed in place, unable to take her eyes off the animals.
"They're trying to get away," she thought.
It was a child's thought, and she tried to dismiss it, but it clung as she watched them, scarcely noticing the fitful flickering of the lights and sound. The animatronic creatures didn't look like they were glitching. Their movement seemed not mechanical, but hysterical, like there was something they needed desperately to do, but, horribly, could not.
"Where's Dave?" John said suddenly.
Charlie met his eyes with a rising dread.
"Oh, no."
They all looked around, but the guard was nowhere in sight.
"We have to find him," Charlie said.
"He probably left already. Who cares?"
Marla said, her voice high and frightened.
"I'm not worried about him," she said grimly.
She turned to John.
"Come on," she said, setting off toward the hallway to the right of the stage.
He glanced at the rest of the group over his shoulder, then followed Charlie at a brisk pace.
"We should find the other control room and see if we can stop all this from there," Jessica said crisply, taking charge. "You and Jason go look for Dave," she told Marla.
"I'll go with them," Lamar said quickly.
"Control room?"
Carlton said, looking at Jessica.
"Control room," she confirmed.
They all set off, moving slowly. The strobing lights distorted the space in front of them, seeming to throw up obstacles that were not there, obscuring the ones that were. The effect was disorienting, a constantly shifting maze of light and noise.
"Ow!"
Marla shouted, and everyone stopped short.
"Are you okay?"
Carlton yelled.
"Yeah, I just bumped into this stupid merry-go-round," she called back.
The speakers were momentarily noiseless, but they shouted across the small distance as if there were a canyon between them. In another hallway, Dave was moving toward a goal. Without the others there to watch, he moved fast, scuttling almost sideways and darting his eyes back over his hunched shoulders from time to time to see he was not followed. There was a large key ring at the belt of his uniform, but only a few keys hung from it. He selected one, opened a door, and let himself into the restaurant's office. He closed the door quickly behind him, cushioning it against noise, even though the group would never hear it this far away, or note it between their own shouts and the blaring of the speakers. He turned on the overhead light. It was steady, illuminating the room without a flicker. On the far wall, there was a tall closet flat against the wall, and he used another key on his ring to open it. Dave stood still in the open door for a long moment, breathing deeply. As he did, his back straightened and his hollow chest seemed to expand, drawing an uncharacteristic confidence from what he saw. An odd, thin smile on his lips, Dave reached out with his fingertips, savoring the moment, and brushed yellow fur. Jessica and Carlton hurried away down the hall toward the second control room, but Marla and the two boys moved more slowly, sticking their heads into the party rooms, then the arcade. The rooms appeared empty, but in the constantly changing light, Jason thought as they moved on, it would be easy to miss just about anything.
Having checked the area, Marla and Lamar headed back into the main room.
"Where are Jessica and Carlton?"
Lamar shouted over another burst of garbled sound. Jason stopped and looked back, and in a fleeting instant, he saw it. A rabbit, outlined in the hall for a split second as the lights flashed on him, then vanishing and appearing again in his place in the party room they had just left.
"Marla!"
Jason shouted.
"Marla!"
His voice was shrill, agitated. She whirled around.
"What? Are you okay?"
"I saw Bonnie. He was there."
"What?"
Marla's eyes went automatically to the stage. Bonnie was still there, moving back and forth in the same odd, spastic movements.
"Jason, look, he's there. He can't move off the stage."
Jason looked. Bonnie was there. "I saw him," he thought, looking back down the hallway, but it was empty. Jessica came running up, out of breath.
"Is everyone okay? I heard screaming."
"We're fine," Lamar said. "Jason thought he saw something."
"Where's Carlton?"
Marla said. She rubbed her temples.
"Ah, this light is giving me such a headache."
"He's still fighting with the controls," Jessica said. "We should find Charlie and John. I think we need to get out of here."
"I think they went that way," Lamar said, pointing to the hall at the far end of the room, just past the stage.
"Come on,"
Jessica said. Jason followed as the group crossed the main dining room again, maneuvering cautiously around tables and chairs. He looked back as they reached the hall. Suddenly, Bonnie appeared again, darting out from the arcade and ducking into the hall that led to Pirate's Cove. Jason watched his sister and the others file through the doorway, then slipped away before they could see him go. He ran across the room, intent on following the rabbit, then slowed his pace when he reached the dark hallway. The lights in the little hall were completely out, and though he could see nothing, it was a minor relief from the pulsing strobes. Jason hugged the wall as he moved, trying to scan ahead of him for signs of movement, but it was too dark. His eyes had not adjusted. After what seemed like ages, he came out of the hall and into Pirate's Cove. From a distance, he could hear his sister's voice, calling his name.
"Guess they noticed I'm gone,"
he thought wryly. He ignored it. Crossing the room, he peered down the other hallway, the one that led to more party rooms, but it was so dark that he could scarcely see more than a few feet ahead. Turning back, he approached the little stage, the out-of-order sign still strung across it.
As if anything in this place is in order.
Suddenly, the curtain moved, and Jason froze. The curtain began pulling back. Jason couldn't bring himself to run. All went dark. Then the lights came on suddenly to reveal Carlton standing in front of him, having emerged from behind the curtain.
"What are you doing back here by yourself? Come on, let's go."
Carlton greeted him with a warm smile. Awash with relief, Jason took a step forward, opening his mouth to speak, and stiffened, struck still with fear. Bonnie suddenly broke through the darkness, appearing beneath the stage lights before them. But it was not Bonnie. This rabbit's yellow fur was almost blinding in the light. He rushed at them, and before Jason could cry out, the giant rabbit had a hold of Carlton from behind, smothering his face with a giant, matted paw, and wrapping his other great arm around Carlton's chest, gripping tightly. Carlton struggled silently, hitting and kicking, but the creature barely seemed to notice. He screamed into the rabbit's paw, but the sound was swallowed whole. As he fought, the rabbit slunk back the way he came, dragging Carlton with him like a prize from the hunt. Jason watched them go, agape. His heart raced, and his breath was shallow. The stifling air around him made him lightheaded. A noise came from behind him, the grinding screech of rusted metal beginning to move, and he leaped forward and turned, moving just in time to avoid a hook as it plunged swiftly downward. Foxy's eyes flashed in synchrony with the lights above, and for a dizzy moment it seemed to Jason that those eyes were the controlling force behind it all, that if Foxy closed his eyes, every light might go out. The animal did not move like the others. It slowly, purposefully, rose between the gap and the curtains, its gleaming eyes reaching a staggering height.
Jason!
It was Charlie's voice, he knew, but he kept staring back and forth, first at Foxy, then at the place where Carlton had been stolen away.
Jason!
She called again, and then she and John were beside him, touching him, shaking him out of his ghastly reverie. John grabbed his hand and pulled him into a run. In the main room, the others were already halfway down the hallway to the outside door, all but Marla, who was waiting anxiously at the entrance, her face flooding with relief when she saw Jason.
Marla! Bonnie, he took Carlton!
Jason yelled, but she just put a hand on his back and pushed him through the door and into the hall.
Go, Jason!
But I saw Bonnie take Carlton!
He cried, but he ran, afraid to stop. They ran down the hall to the outside door, all bouncing with a frightened impatience as they filed through to the alley one by one. There was no way to go faster. When they were all through, Charlie looked down the hallway for a long moment, but there was no one coming. She shoved the door closed and stepped out of the way as Lamar and John wrestled the shelf back into place, blocking it off.
No one saw Dave, Charlie said.
It was not a question. They all shook their heads.
He must have taken off when the lights started going haywire, Lamar offered, but he did not sound convinced.
Carlton! Jason cried out again. Carlton is still in there! Bonnie took him!
They all glanced around. Carlton was not with them.
Oh, no, Jessica said. He's still inside.
Bonnie took him,
Jason said, choking out the words one by one, his voice shaking.
I saw it. Bonnie was there. He was in Pirate's Cove, and he grabbed Carlton and carried him away. I couldn't stop him.
He scrubbed a sleeve across his eyes, wiping tears.
Oh, sweetheart.
Marla hugged him, and he clung to her, hiding his face in her shirt.
No, it was a trick of the light. Bonnie couldn't do that. He's just a robot. He was on stage when we left.
Jason closed his eyes. He had only glanced for a second at the main stage as they were leaving, but it was true. Bonnie had been there, moving in strange and clumsy twists and bends, stuck in place. He pulled away from his sister's arms.
I saw it,
he insisted, more weakly.
Bonnie took him.
The others exchanged glances above his head. Charlie looked at Marla, who shrugged.
We have to go back in, Charlie said. We have to get him.
Jessica was nodding, but John cleared his throat.
I think we need help, he said. It's not safe in there.
Let's get Carlton's dad, Marla said. I'm not taking Jason back in there.
Charlie wanted to protest, but she bit her tongue. They were right. Of course they were right. Whatever had just happened was beyond them. They needed help. Chapter 7. They made their way back through the corridors of the abandoned mall, not bothering to be cautious with their footsteps or the beams of their lights.
So much for being sneaky,
Charlie said darkly, but no one responded. By silent consensus, their pace quickened steadily. By the time they reached the parking lot, they were almost running. Spotting her car as they came out the front door, Charlie felt an almost physical relief to see it, like it was an old friend.
Someone should stay here, she said, pausing with her hand on the door handle. We can't leave Carlton.
No, Marla said firmly. We're leaving now. They looked at her in surprise for a moment. Suddenly, she was talking to them all the way she talked to Jason. Sister knows best. Lamar and Jason exchanged glances, but no one said anything.
We're going into town, all of us, she added, giving Charlie a warning look. And we're finding help.
They hurried into their cars. As Charlie took the wheel, John got into the passenger seat, and she smiled tightly at him. Jessica climbed into the back a moment later, and Charlie felt a minor disappointment. She had wanted to talk to him alone. "We're running for help. It's not a date," she scolded herself. But that hadn't really been the point. He felt safe, a touchstone amid the strange things that were happening all around them. She looked over at him, but he was staring out the window. They pulled out of the lot, following Marla's car as she sped into the darkness. When they reached the town, Marla yanked her car to the side of the main street and stopped, and Charlie followed suit. Before the car had fully come to a halt, Jessica leaped out of the back seat and started running. Marla followed a step behind. They stopped in front of the movie theater, and only then did Charlie see that there was a cop in uniform beneath the marquee, leaning back against his black and white car. His eyes widened at the sight of the young women barreling toward him, and he took an involuntary step back as Marla started talking without pausing for breath.
"Please, you've got to come,"
Marla was finishing as the others caught up. The cop looked a little bewildered. He had a shiny pink face, and his hair was so short it was entirely covered by his hat. He was young, maybe mid-twenties, Charlie realized, and he was looking at them skeptically.
"Is this an actual emergency?" he said. "You may not realize it, but pranks can get you into real trouble."
Jessica rolled her eyes and stepped forward, closing the distance between them.
"We're not playing a prank," she said crisply,
and Charlie suddenly remembered how tall she was.
"Our friend is trapped in that abandoned shopping mall, and it's your job to help us."
"The shopping mall?"
He seemed confused, then looked in the direction they'd come from.
"That shopping mall?"
His eyes widened, then he frowned at them reproachfully, looking remarkably like a disappointed parent despite his youth.
"What were you doing up there in the first place?"
Charlie and Marla exchanged glances, but Jessica didn't blink.
"Deal with us later. He's in danger, and you have to help us, Officer..."
She leaned in and peered at his name tag.
"Officer Dunn, do you want me to go to the fire department?"
Despite her fear, Charlie almost laughed. Jessica said it as if she were in a store, threatening to take her business elsewhere. It was so absurd it should have gotten her no more than a puzzled glance, but Dunn reached for his radio hastily.
"No," he said. "Hang on."
He pressed a button, and the radio emitted a short burst of static. Charlie felt a brief chill at the sound, and as she looked around, she saw John stiffen and Jason take a tiny step closer to Marla. Not seeming to notice their reactions, Dunn barked incomprehensible sounds into his radio, talking in cop code, and Charlie suddenly had a flash of memory of running around the yard, whispering into walkie-talkies with Marla. They could never understand each other on the cheap toys her father had found in the drugstore bargains bin, but they didn't mind. Actual communication was never the point.
"Charlie, come on!"
Jessica shouted at her, and Charlie came back to herself. Everyone was heading toward the cars and piling back in. Marla pulled out in front, and the cop followed her, with Charlie bringing up the rear.
"Why doesn't he have the siren on?"
Jessica said. Her voice was thin and brittle, as if her only choices were a sharp tongue or tears.
"He doesn't believe us," John said softly.
"He should have the siren on,"
Jessica said, and this time it was almost a whisper. Charlie's knuckles were white on the steering wheel as she stared straight ahead at the cop's red taillights. When they got back to the mall, Jessica dashed ahead, forcing the rest of them to run behind her. Charlie didn't mind. It felt good to run. Purposeful. Lamar was talking to the cop as they ran, shouting over the noise of their thudding feet.
"The restaurant is all boarded up, but there's a door left open," he said,
the words broken by his uneven breathing.
"Behind the plastic. You move it. Dark alley. Carlton smells like feet."
Officer Dunn's steps stuttered briefly, but he regained his stride. When they reached the alley, they slowed their pace, moving more cautiously down the narrow hall until they came to the door.
"Right here,"
John said, and Dunn moved forward to help with the shelf. They drew it back too fast, the contents rattling and wobbling. The shelf pitched backward, and tools, cables, and paint cans full of nails crashed to the floor.
Ow!
John yelled as a hammer bounced off his foot. They all watched as the things scattered, some rolling away and vanishing down the dark corridor.
What?
Jason wailed, and they all looked up from the spill. He was pointing at the door.
What is this?
Marla gasped. The door had chains strung across it from top to bottom, three enormous padlocks holding them all together. The links were bolted into the metal frame of the door, and they were heavy, too heavy to cut without special tools. It was all rusty. The whole thing looked as though it had been there for years. Charlie walked up to the door and touched a chain, as if to be sure it was real.
This wasn't here, she said,
the words sounding inane even as she spoke.
We have to get him out,
Jason cried haltingly, his hands covering his eyes.
Bonnie is going to kill him, and it's my fault.
What's he talking about?
The police officer said, looking at them with renewed suspicion.
Who is Bonnie, and why is she going to hurt your friend?
It's a robot, Charlie said quickly. The robots from Freddy Fazbear's are still there, and they still work.
Freddy Fazbear's?
Dunn's face flushed, and he looked at the door again.
I used to go there as a kid, he said softly,
his tone caught between nostalgia and fear. He caught himself quickly and cleared his throat.
He came to life,
Jason insisted, no longer making the effort to hide his tears. Dunn bent down to his height, his tone softening.
What's your name?
He asked.
We have to get him out,
Jason repeated.
His name is Jason, Marla said, and Jason glared at her.
Jason, Dunn said.
He put a hand on Jason's shoulder, glancing at the others with an obvious suspicion.
He thinks we made him say that, Charlie realized.
Jason wriggled in Dunn's grasp, but the officer did not let him go, looking him in the eye to ask the next question.
Jason, did they tell you to say this? What's going on here?
Irritated, Jason pulled free and took a large step back.
That's what really happened, he said firmly.
Officer Dunn exhaled, a long, slow vent of frustration, then got to his feet, shedding his kid-friendly act.
So, the robots took your friend, he said.
I know what you're trying to pull, said his tone.
We were in there, Charlie stated flatly, keeping her voice level, as if saying it calmly and plainly enough might convince him that they were not telling lies. Our friend didn't make it out.
The officer looked again at the chains.
Look,
he said, apparently deciding to give them the benefit of the doubt.
I don't know how you got in there in the first place, and right now I don't want to know. But the machinery in there is old. It hasn't been touched in 10 years. Chances are it's pretty spooky. Heck, I wouldn't want to go in there. So even though I can't blame you for being freaked out, I can guarantee you those robots in there aren't moving by themselves. That place is dead, and it needs to be left alone, he said with a forced chuckle.
Jason set his jaw, but he didn't say anything.
I think you all need to go home,
Dunn finished, the statement sounding more like a threat than advice. They looked at one another. After a moment of uncomfortable silence, Jessica looked to Charlie.
These chains weren't here before, right?
She faltered, looking back at her friends for confirmation, like she was beginning to doubt her own memory.
No, Charlie said instantly. They weren't. We aren't leaving, and we need your help.
Fine, Dunn said shortly. What's his name?
He produced a notebook seemingly from nowhere.
Carlton Burke,
Jessica said. She was about to spell it for him when suddenly Officer Dunn put down his pen and closed his eyes, his nostrils flaring. He glared at them,
no longer looking quite so young.
I'm going to give you one more chance. Tell me exactly what happened.
He spoke slowly, emphasizing the spaces between his words. He was in control again, no longer out of his depth, like he suddenly understood everything. They tried to explain all at once, talking over one another. Jessica's voice was loudest and calmest, but even she could not keep her anxiety from bleeding through. Charlie hung back, quiet. Tell me exactly what happened. Where were they supposed to start? With the night? With the week? With Michael? With the first time her father picked up a circuit board? How was anyone ever to respond to something like, "Tell me what happened"?
The cop was nodding, and he picked up the radio again, but this time he spoke comprehensibly.
Nora, call Burke. It's his kid. I'm up at the old mall site.
There was an answering burst of static, and the officer turned his attention back to them.
Come on, he said.
Come on where?
John said.
Off the property.
Marla started to protest, but Dunn interrupted.
I'm escorting you off the property, he said.
He pulled the baton from his belt and pointed with it.
Come on, Lamar said.
Jason was still staring sullenly at the ground, and Lamar gave him a gentle nudge on the shoulder.
Jason, come on. We have to do what he says now, okay?
But Carlton!
Jason said loudly, and Lamar shook his head.
I know. It's okay, we'll find him. But we have to go now.
He guided Jason toward the mouth of the alley, and everyone followed. The police officer walked behind, following Charlie a little too closely. She sped up, but so did he, and she resigned herself to being shadowed. When they got to the parking lot, he directed them to wait by the car and walked off a few paces, speaking into the radio again, too far away to hear.
What's going on?
Jason said. He was beginning to whine. He heard the tone in his voice and tried to modulate it.
I am not a little kid, he reminded himself.
No one answered, but Marla rubbed his back absently, and he did not move away. Long minutes passed in silence. Jessica sat on the hood of the car, facing away from the rest of the group. Charlie wanted to go to her, but she did not. In her distress, Jessica was closing down, going stiff and cold and snippy, and Charlie did not think she had what it took to break through that without breaking down herself.
Was he talking about Carlton's dad?
Charlie asked, but no one had time to answer. Headlights appeared, and a car pulled in beside them. The man who got out was tall and thin, and his light hair could have been either blonde or gray.
Carlton's dad,
Marla whispered, a late answer to Charlie's question. The man smiled as he approached.
Carlton's dad, he confirmed. Though, since you're all grown up now, you'd better call me Clay.
They all muttered it, half in greeting, half just to test it out. Jason covered his mouth self-consciously, tonguing the invisible gap in his molars.
I thought our days of mischief would be behind us, no?
Clay said, his expression good-humored. Jessica slid off the hood of Charlie's car, her face drawn.
I'm so sorry. He's missing, she said tightly. I don't know what happened. He was right with us.
Bonnie kidnapped him,
Jason burst out.
I saw. The rabbit took him.
Clay started to smile, then stopped himself when he saw their faces.
Oh, kids, I'm sorry. You haven't been around in a while. I'm afraid Carlton is playing a joke on you. All of you.
What?
Lamar said.
Oh, come on. With you guys back in town, he couldn't resist, Clay said. Whatever happened, I guarantee he set it up. He'll probably pop out of the bushes any minute now.
There was a silence as they all waited against probability. Nothing happened.
Well, Clay said at last, that would have been too much to ask. Come on, why don't you come back to our place? I'll make you all some hot chocolate, and when Carlton finally shows up, you can tell him he's grounded.
Okay, Charlie said, without waiting for the consent of the others. She wanted to believe Clay, wanted to believe that Carlton was all right and would show up laughing. But almost as badly, she wanted to go somewhere where an adult was in charge, someone who would make hot chocolate and assure them there was no such thing as monsters. Her father had never made that claim. Her father could never have told her that lie. No one objected, and so they started up their caravan again, trailing Clay home. They all settled into their accustomed places. Charlie, John, and Jessica in Charlie's car, and Marla, Jason, and Lamar in Marla's. In the rearview mirror, Charlie saw Officer Dunn's car still right behind them.
Is he just going this way, or is he making sure we go where we're told? She wondered.
But it didn't really matter. They weren't planning on flight. At Carlton's house, they filed in through the front door. Charlie looked back in time to see the police car drive on by.
He was following us.
As they climbed the steps, John leaned in to whisper in her ear.
I didn't realize how rich they were when I was a kid, he said, and she stifled a laugh.
It was true. The house was enormous. It was 3 stories high, and it sprawled out into the woods that surrounded it, so wide that Charlie thought there must have been whole rooms where all you could see out the window was trees. Clay showed them to the living room, which looked well used, the furniture mismatched and the rugs, dark and durable, made to take stains.
Carlton's mom, who you can call Betty now, is asleep, Clay said. The soundproofing is pretty good. Just don't shout or crash around.
They chorused promises, and he nodded, satisfied, and vanished through a doorway. They dispersed themselves over the furniture, sitting on couches and chairs. Charlie sat on the rug between Jessica's chair and Lamar's. She wanted them all to stay close together. John sat down beside her and gave a little smile.
Did we get pranked? Marla asked. I guess maybe. I'm not sure what else would explain it,
Jessica said listlessly, staring into the empty fireplace.
I mean, none of us even knows each other that well. Not really. Maybe he would do something like that.
They all shifted uncomfortably. It was true. They had been behaving as if their time apart were just a little break, like they could just fill one another in on what they had been up to, and it would be just like it was, just like their group had never split up. But 10 years was too long for that to be true, and deep down, everyone knew it. Charlie darted her eyes at John. She felt a little embarrassed, but she could not have expressed why. Clay came back in, carrying a tray of steaming mugs and a bag of little marshmallows.
Here you are, he said jovially. Hot chocolate for everyone, even me.
He set the tray down on the coffee table and took a seat in a battered green armchair that seemed to fit him like a coat, as accustomed to his body as he was to its form. They reached forward and took the cups. Only Jason reached for the marshmallows. Clay looked around from face to face.
Look, he said. I know you don't believe me, but Carlton does things like this. Although, I have to admit, this is probably the weirdest. It's not right, making you relive all that stuff from when you were kids.
He stared into his mug for a long moment.
I need to have another talk with him, he said quietly. Believe me, my son has a strange sense of humor, he went on. You know, for high school we sent him to a place in the next town over. No one knew him. He managed to convince his classmates and his teachers that he had a twin brother at the school for the first month of class. I don't know how on earth he managed it, but I didn't find out until he got tired of the act, and I started getting calls from school that one of my sons had gone missing.
Charlie smiled weakly,
but she was not convinced. This was different.
This is different, Marla said, as if reading Charlie's thoughts. Jason saw him disappear. He was terrified. It's cruel, if it's a prank.
Marla shook her head with anger and scratched her nails against the porcelain cup.
If it's a prank, she repeated in a softer tone.
She looked at Charlie, her face stormy, and Charlie knew that if Carlton had, in fact, set all of this up, Marla would never speak to him again. Their happy reunion was over.
Yes, Clay said. I know, but he doesn't see it that way.
He took a sip of cocoa, searching for words.
The twins, they had totally different personalities. Sean was this outgoing, cheerful guy. He was on the debate team. He played soccer, for goodness sake. Carlton had never gotten near a sports game without being forced. I don't know how he kept it up.
Still, Marla said, but she sounded less convinced.
The worst part was, Clay went on, talking more to himself now than to the teenagers. Sean had a girlfriend. She really liked him, too, but he was just playing the part. Poor girl had been dating a guy who didn't even exist. I think he was surprised when he realized how upset people were. He gets carried away and just assumes everyone is having as much fun as he is.
Charlie looked at John, and he met her glance anxiously.
We don't know each other. Not really. Maybe he did set it up, she said aloud.
Maybe,
Jessica echoed.
I saw him,
Jason said loudly. Before anyone could respond, he stormed out of the room, disappearing through a doorway. Marla stood automatically and moved to follow him, but Clay put up a hand.
Let him go, he said. He needs some time to himself, and I want to talk to the rest of you.
He set his mug down and leaned forward.
I know you were just kidding around, but I don't want to hear you kids joking about Freddy Fazbear's. You know, I wasn't the chief back then. I was still a detective, and I was working on those disappearances. To this day, it was the worst thing I've ever had to see. It's not something to joke about.
He looked at Charlie. His gray eyes were hard, and the lines of his face were immobile. He was no longer the friendly father figure, but the police chief, staring as if he could see right through her. Charlie had a sudden urge to confess, but she had nothing to confess to.
I'm especially surprised at you, Charlie, Clay said quietly.
Charlie blushed, shame rising up in her with the flush of heat. She wanted to protest, to explain herself, to say anything that might soften the eyes that seemed to bore into her skull. Instead, she ducked her head and muttered an indistinct apology. Lamar broke the silence.
Mr. Burke, Clay, did they ever find out who did it? I thought they arrested somebody.
Clay didn't respond for a long moment. He was still looking at Charlie, and she felt as if he were trying to tell her something, or else read something in her face.
Clay?
Marla said, and he seemed to come back to himself. He looked around the group, his expression dark.
Yes, he said quietly. We did arrest someone. I did, in fact. And I am as sure now that he was guilty as I was then. So what happened?
Lamar asked. There was a hush among the group, as if something very important was about to happen.
There were no bodies, Clay Burke said. We knew it was him. There was no doubt in my mind. But the children had disappeared. They were never found, and without their bodies.
He stopped talking, staring off into the middle distance as if scarcely aware that they were there.
But kidnapping, Charlie said. They disappeared.
She was suddenly furious, appalled at the obvious injustice.
How can this man be walking around somewhere? What if he does it again?
She felt Marla's hand on her arm, and she nodded, settling back, trying to calm down. But the anger was still there inside, seething under the surface of her skin. Clay was looking at her with something like curiosity in his eyes.
Charlie, he said, justice penalizes the guilty, but it must also protect the innocent. It means that sometimes the guilty get away with terrible things, but it is the price we pay.
He sounded grave, his words weighty. Charlie opened her mouth to argue.
But this was my price, she wanted to say. But before she spoke, she looked at his face.
He had a grim conviction about him. What he was saying mattered very much to him, and he believed it utterly.
It's how you sleep at night, she thought with an uncharacteristic bitterness.
They locked eyes for a long moment. Then Charlie sighed and nodded, giving up the challenge. Intellectually, she didn't even disagree with him. Clay sat up suddenly in his chair.
So, he said brightly, I think it's a bit too late for you girls to be driving back to that motel. Why don't you spend the night here? We have two more guest rooms, and you can scold Carlton for his little prank in the morning, he added with a grin.
Lamar and John showed Charlie, Marla, and Jessica up to the bedrooms, and Jason reemerged as they headed up the stairs, joining the group like he had never been gone.
So Jason and I will take one, Marla said. And Jessica, you and Charlie can have the other.
I want to stay with Lamar,
Jason said instantly, and Lamar grinned widely before he could help himself.
Yeah, okay, he said.
He glanced at Marla over her brother's head, and she shrugged.
Take him, she said. Keep him if you want.
So that means someone gets her own room, she went on. Or we could all stay together. I know everything is fine, but I kind of feel like we should stay together. She was voicing Charlie's precise thoughts from only a little while before, but now Charlie jumped in.
I'll take the other room, she said.
Marla gave her a dubious look, and even John looked a little surprised, but Charlie just looked at them and said nothing. When the door closed behind her, Charlie sighed with relief. She went to the window. It was as she imagined, nothing in view but the trees. The house seemed completely isolated, though she knew that the driveway and the road were just on the other side. From outside, she could hear nocturnal birds and the rustling of other, larger creatures on the ground below. She felt suddenly restless, wide awake. Looking out the window, she almost wanted to go outside, to slip into the woods and see what they concealed. She looked at her watch. It was long past midnight, so with reluctance, she took off her shoes and lay down on the bed. It was, like everything else in Carlton's house, well-worn, the kind of furniture only owned by people who have been wealthy for generations, whose ancestors could afford things of such high quality that they lasted for 100 years. Charlie closed her eyes in what she assumed would be a futile effort to find rest. But as she lay there, listening to the sound of the woods and Jessica and Marla gossiping and laughing in the next room, she felt as if she were sinking into the mattress. Her breath deepened, and she was soon asleep. She woke suddenly, startled from sleep. She was a little girl again, and her father was asleep in the next room. It was summer, and the windows were all open. It had started to rain, and the wind rushed into the room in great gusts, blowing her bedroom curtains in a frenetic dance and ushering in a fine mist. But that was not why she awoke. There was something in the air, something unshakable that gripped her. Something was very wrong. Charlie climbed out of bed, lowering herself carefully onto the floor. Beside her bed stood Stanley the Unicorn, patient and deactivated, staring at her with lifeless eyes. She patted his nose, as if giving him comfort might bring it to her as well. Quietly, she snuck past him and out into the hallway, uncertain what compelled her. She crept down the hallway,
past her father's room to the stairs, and ducked down beside the wooden banister as if its open slats could protect her from anything at all. She held fast to it as she made her way down the staircase, letting the rail take her weight as she avoided the boards that creaked. One by one, she took the steps. It felt like ages, like years might pass before she reached the bottom, and when she arrived, she might be an old woman, her whole life spun out in the descent of these stairs. At last, Charlie reached the end of the stairs, and she looked down to see that she had changed. Her body was no longer small, nightgown-clad and barefoot, but her teenage body, tall, strong, and fully clothed. When she straightened from her fearful crouch, she stood taller than the banister, and she looked around at her childhood home, startled. "This is me," she thought. "Yes, this is now." Something banged in front of her. The front door was wide open and thudding irregularly against the wall, caught by the wind. The rain was whipping in, soaking the floor and lashing the coat rack that stood beside it, rocking it back and forth like it weighed nothing at all. Leaves and small branches were scattered on the floor, ripped from the trees and swept in, but Charlie's eyes went to her old, familiar shoes, her favorites. They were placed neatly beside the mat, black patent leather with straps, and she could see the rain pooling inside and ruining them. Charlie stood still for a moment, transfixed, too far for the rain to reach, but close enough for the haze to slowly wet her face. She ought to go to the door and close it. Instead, Charlie backed away slowly, not taking her eyes from the border of the storm. She took a step, then another, and her back hit something solid. She whirled around, startled, and saw it. It was the thing from her father's workshop, the terrible, twitching thing. It stood on its own, bent and twisted, with a narrow, reddish canine face and an almost human body. Its clothing was rags, its metal joints and limbs stark and exposed, but Charlie registered only its eyes, the silver eyes that flashed at her, on and off, over and over, blinking in and out of existence. Charlie wanted to run, but her feet would not move. She could feel her pulse in her throat, choking her, and she struggled to breathe. The thing convulsed, and in slow, jerking motions its hand rose up and reached out to touch her face. Charlie drew in a shaking breath, unable to duck away, and then it stopped, the hand only inches from her cheek. Charlie braced herself, her breath shallow and her eyes screwed shut, but the touch of metal and ragged cloth on her skin did not come. She opened her eyes. The thing had gone still, and the silver light in its eyes was dimmed, nearly out. Charlie backed away from it, watching warily, but it did not move, and she began to wonder if it had shut down, run out of the finite current that powered it. Its shoulders were hunched forward, hapless, and it stared dully past her as if it were lost. Charlie felt a sudden stab of sorrow for this creature, that same feeling of lonely kinship she felt in her father's workshop so many years ago. "Does it hurt?" she had asked. She was old enough now to know the answer. All at once, the thing lurched to life. Charlie felt her head go light as it took an awkward step toward her, hurtling its body forward as if it had only just learned to walk. Its head turned frantically from side to side, and its arms jerked up and down with dangerous abandon. Something shattered. It was a lamp. The thing had knocked over a ceramic lamp, and the sound of it bursting on the wooden floor shook Charlie from her stupor. She turned and ran up the stairs, scrambling as fast as her legs would carry her to her father's door, too scared to even call out for him. As she clambered up the steps, some small part of her realized that they were too big, that she was nearly on all fours, tripping barefoot over the hem of her nightgown. She was a little girl again, she realized in a bursting moment of awareness. And then it was over, and being a little girl was the only thing she could remember. She tried again to scream for her father, but he was already there, She did not need to call him. He was standing in the hall, and she grabbed at his shirt tails as she crouched behind him. He put a hand on her shoulder, steadying her, and for the first time, her father's touch did not make Charlie feel that she was safe. Peeking out from behind his back, Charlie could see the thing's ears, then its face, as it climbed the stairs in its fitful, jerking steps. Her father stood calm, watching it, as it climbed the final stair, and then Charlie's father grasped her hand and disentangled it, gently forcing her to let him go. He went forward to meet the thing in large, even strides, but as he reached out to it, Charlie could see that his hands were shaking. He touched the thing, put his hands on either side of its face for a long moment, as if he were caressing it, and its limbs stopped, head still moving gently from side to side. It looked almost bewildered, as if it, too, had awakened to something strange and frightening. Charlie's father did something she could not see, and the thing stopped moving. Its head drooped, defeated, and its arms fell to its sides. Charlie backed up toward her room, feeling her way along the wall behind her, not daring to look away from the thing until she was safely behind her door. As she looked out one last time into the hallway, she could just barely see the glint from its eyes, cast down at the floor. Suddenly, the little silver lights flickered. The head did not move, but in a slow, calculated arc, the eyes swung to meet Charlie's gaze. Charlie whimpered, but she did not look away, and then the head snapped up with a crack like something breaking. Charlie startled out of sleep, an involuntary shudder running through her. She put a hand to her throat, feeling her heartbeat there, too quick and too hard. She darted her eyes around the room, putting together where she was one piece at a time. The bed. Not her own. The room. Dark. She was alone. The window. The woods outside. Carlton's house. Her breath slowed. The process had only taken seconds, but it disturbed her to be so disoriented. She blinked, but the afterburn of those silver eyes was still with her, glowing behind her eyelids as if they had been real. Charlie stood and went to the window, thrust it open, and leaned out, desperate to breathe in the night air. Did that happen? The dream felt like memory, felt like something that had happened just moments ago. But that was the nature of dreams, wasn't it? They felt real, and then you woke up. She closed her eyes and tried to catch the thread, but it was too difficult to tell what was the dream and what was not. She shivered in the breeze, though it was not cold, and brought herself back inside. She looked at her watch. Only a couple of hours had passed, and it was still hours more until daylight, but sleep felt impossible. Charlie put on her shoes and shuffled quietly through the hall and down the stairs, hoping not to wake her friends. She went out to the porch, sitting down on the front steps and leaning back to look up at the sky. There were traces of clouds overhead, but the stars still shone through, scattered overhead, uncountable. She tried to lose herself in them as she had as a child, but as she gazed up at the pinpoint lights, all she could see were eyes, looking back at her. There was a noise behind her, and she jumped, whirling to press her back against the railing. John was standing behind her with a startled look on his face. They stared at each other for a moment like strangers, and then Charlie found her voice.
"Hey, sorry. Did I wake you up again?"
John shook his head and came to sit beside her.
"No, not really. I heard you go out, or I figured it was you. I was awake, though. Jason snores like a guy about 3 times his size."
Charlie laughed.
"I had a weird dream," she said.
John nodded, waiting for her to go on, but she did not.
"What did people think of my father?" she asked instead.
John leaned back and looked at the stars for a moment, then pointed.
"That's Cassiopeia," he said, and she squinted in the direction of his finger.
"It's Orion," she corrected. John, I'm serious. What did people think about him?
He shrugged uncomfortably. Charlie, I was a little kid, you know? Nobody told me anything.
I was a little kid once myself, she said. Nobody tells you anything, but they talk in front of you like you're not there. I remember your mom and Lamar's mom talking, making bets on how long Marla's new stepdad would stick around.
What did they come up with? John said, amused.
Your mom was banking on 3 months. Lamar's mom was more optimistic, Charlie said, grinning, but then her face grew serious again. I can tell you know something, she said quietly, and after a moment he nodded.
Some people thought he did it, yeah, he admitted.
What? Charlie was aghast. She stared at him, eyes wide, scarcely breathing. They thought what?
John glanced at her nervously. I thought that's what you were asking, he said.
Charlie shook her head. Some people thought he did it. No. I meant, what did they think of him as a person? Did they think he was odd or kind or... I didn't know.
She trailed off, lost in the magnitude of this new truth.
People thought he did it. Of course they did. It was his restaurant. The first child to vanish was his child. In the absence of a confession or a conviction, who else would anyone think of?
Charlie shook her head again.
Charlie, John said hesitantly. I'm sorry. I just assumed. You must have known people would think that, though. If not then now.
Well, I didn't, she snapped. She felt a hollow satisfaction when he drew back, hurt. She took a deep breath.
I know it sounds obvious, she said in more even tones. But it just never, ever occurred to me that anyone would think he was responsible. And then afterward, after he committed... But that would have only reinforced their suspicions, she realized as she said it.
People thought it was because of the guilt, John said, almost to himself.
It was. Charlie felt anger welling up inside her, the dam about to break, and she held it back, biting off words in short, sharp bursts. Of course he felt guilt. It was his restaurant, his life's work, his creations, and it was all turned into a massacre. Don't you think that's enough?
Her voice sounded vicious, even to her own ears.
Apologize, she thought, but she ignored it. People thought he did it. He wouldn't. He couldn't. But if he had, how would she even have known? I knew him, she thought fiercely. But did she? She loved him, trusted him, with the blind devotion of a 7-year-old girl, even now. She understood him with the knowing and not knowing that comes of being a child. When you focus on your parent as if they are the center of the earth, that thing on which your survival depends, only later do you realize their flaws, their scars, and their weaknesses. Charlie had never had the dawning moments of realization as she grew older that her father was only human. She had never had the chance. To her, he was still mythic. Still larger than life, still the man who could deactivate the monsters. He was also the man who made them. How well did she really know him? The rage was gone, had ebbed back to wherever it rose from, and she was empty of it, her insides dry and vacant. She closed her eyes and put a hand to her forehead. I'm sorry, she said. And John touched her shoulder for a brief moment. Don't be, he said. Charlie put her hands over her face. She did not feel like crying, but she didn't want him to see her face. She was thinking of things that were too new, too awful, to think in front of someone else. How would I have known if he did?
Charlie? John cleared his throat and repeated her name. Charlie,
You know he didn't do it, right? Mr. Burke said they knew who did, but they had to let him go. He got away with it, remember? Charlie didn't move, but something like hope stirred inside her.